Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined once again for our annual discussion of The Massacre, the 24-hour horror film festival that we do every year for Scary Movie Month, by the champion of The Massacre, JB.
All hail the king, baby. And this year, Rusty chose Army of Darkness as the last film, and that is the last line of that film.
Yeah.
So it was a very wonderful... The people who were left, and there weren't quite as many as in the past.
Really?
Not that I should complain, because I have my little shortcut, but the audience just exploded when Campbell said that.
Sure. We did things a little bit differently. We'll talk about it in a minute here. But as you know, Scary Movie Month is going on at fthismovie.net. We have the Scary Movie Challenge. Every time you watch a horror movie in October, go to fthismovie.net. And post your 7-word review under the tab where it says Scary Movie Challenge. You should also follow us on Twitter. We're at F This Movie. And you should like us on Facebook if you haven't done that already. And if you ever want to email us, we are fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com.
Communication is a wonderful thing.
Yeah. We're going to skip the whole, have you seen anything scary lately? Because we've both seen a bunch of scary things that we will talk about over the course of this podcast.
That's probably a good idea.
Yeah. In case you guys don't
know. Unless you want to talk about how scary Captain Phillips is.
We've done, I think, 3 shows previously on The Massacres, which is, like I said, a 24-hour horror film festival put on by Rusty Nails and Movieside. You can go back and listen to our old episodes. Things were different this year. It was at a different theater.
And I think we would agree that for a number of reasons, and we're not going to go over them, last year was just miserable.
It was a conflagration
of different variables, and it took us months to overcome it.
That is true.
I don't think you're over last year's yet.
No, I don't know. Maybe not.
But one thing I'm here to tell you is, for whatever reason, the patio works great, good, which I consider a personal vindication, because when the Covalis family reopened the patio and I went there for the first time at Doug's urging, remember, I think Doug went there first, the first thing I thought was, could The Massacre be here? And I actually told Rusty, who at the time was using the portage, and he said he didn't think the patio was going to work because of the public transportation situation. But let me tell you, I don't know much. But the patio works a hell of a lot better than the portage.
That's great. Yeah, there's basically 3 sort of repertory theaters in Chicago, and in 3 years, it's been at 3 different theaters. It used to be held annually at the Music Box Theater, which we talk about all the time. There was a split, so last year it was held at the Portage, and through a series of ugly events, through real no fault of the people at the Portage, that theater has been shuttered probably permanently.
And it's very sad, and it's horrible. But, you know, and I'll quote this for, okay, now the fact that we've been up starts to take its toll. One of my many favorite Adam Riske quotes is that back when the Portage was a going concern, you were always kind of worried that a wrecking ball was going to come through the wall. So that was only one of the problems last year.
Yeah. This year was at the patio, which we will talk about, but let's do our 7-word reviews. You guys have been sharing a bunch and doing awesome, so we have a few that we would like to read.
These are especially worthy of commendation. I almost said condemnation. Once again, Ed Perry needs to slow down, but he posted for Dracula's Daughter, "Is it me or is she hot? I am here to tell you, Ed, she is indescribably hot. Let me tell you. Dracula's Daughter and The Bride of Frankenstein." Now, I'm about to send Ed Perry into a paroxysm of delight. Ed, I would like you to imagine Dracula's Daughter doing it with The Bride of Frankenstein. Hold on.
I know where you're going.
Just let that...
You were going to make the stipulation, it has to be in black and white.
Well, of
that's
course,
a given, right? That's
of
a given.
Course, you'd have to be in black and white.
Mike Young has one of my favorites. He says, of The Fog, Jamie Lee is on the Atkins diet.
Yeah.
Boom.
It took me a couple seconds
that's
to get
awesome.
That one. Tom Smale, in his review of The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, has written, Shyamalan, How does M. Night pronounce his last name?
Shyamalan.
Shyamalan. Shyamalan, this is a proper twist ending.
Boom. Tom Bartman, another Tom, says of The Burning, Cropsy, when your parents can't afford Jason.
Also, Tom Bartman's review of Grease. Grease? Oh, I just screwed it up. We've been up. Tom Bartman's review of Carrie was, it's just like Grease, except more fire.
Diego S. says of Sleepaway Camp, why is Angela such a dick? Oh.
Oh, and I got to cross that out. I wrote that one down, too.
It's a good one.
I like that one a lot, too. Sal, our friend Sal, has written a 7-word review of Frozen, which I first saw at your house and enjoyed very much. And his review reads, fuck werewolves. Real wolves are scary enough.
Danny says, drag me to hell. One girl, everything pukes in her mouth.
I like that one, too. Mike with a Y, his review of Sleepy Hollow from 1999 is Baba homage, brutal beheadings, beautiful busting bosoms.
Look at the alliteration on Mike with a Y. Angela Hager says Dawn of the Dead 2004. Those were fast motherfuckers. I definitely die.
Yeah, I like that one too. Michael Piccoli, or Piccoli, take your pick, has posted 2 really good ones. For Horror of Dracula, he's written, Dracula's demise means no possible sequels, right? And, 2 days earlier, he posted a review of Night of the Creeps, and he wrote, college as I choose to remember it.
Tom Maloney, do we do a Tom Maloney? Urban legend, parkas are pretty popular at Pendleton University.
There you go. Luke Ciancio, who until recently posted what was your favorite
review. Yes, and I forgot to write it down.
Ever.
I don't even remember what it was. I feel terrible.
I'm not going to get the 7 words thing, but it was for World War Z, and it was like, oh, just give me AIDS.
Yeah, right.
But in 7 words. But Luke also reviewed From Dusk Till Dawn, and his 7-word review of From Dusk Till Dawn reads, holy water-filled condoms broke pretty easily.
Alex Focus, I hope I'm saying that right, F-O-K-A-S, basket case, my brother isn't so bad after all.
There you go. Illyria has posted a triumvirate, a hat trick, if you will, of great reviews. On October 9th, she wrote about The Black Cat, Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi now kiss.
That was the other one I had.
And then... the same day, she posted for The Blob, a personal favorite, come for cheese, stay for backwards driving. And then she wrote the very same day. Good. Oh, this was like 927, 929, 932. Illyria wrote for House of Frankenstein, Freaky Friday for classic horror movie actors, which I thought was pretty funny.
Do you have any more?
Yeah.
Okay.
JP reviews The Blob and reviews it by simply stating in 7 words, don't poke the goo with a stick, which I talked about in a recent column. And one of the films at the massacre this year was Slither. And there's a scene where Michael Rooker approaches some goo and he pokes it with a stick. And my wife and I are currently having some remodeling done. And there was a crack in our foundation and they fixed it. And she went outside and she noticed some white stuff that looked like goo. And before she could think about what she was doing, listeners, do you know what she did? She poked at it with a stick. All week long, I'm getting these messages that I'm on to something, that's what horror films are about. Horror films are about the fact that we humans...
poke things with sticks.
We cannot be told not to poke things with stick.
Yeah.
Eric, our friend Eric, is so clever. I have to bring these up. For Serpent in the Rainbow, he wrote that Pullman's pierced scrotum is my spirit animal. And for Exorcist 2, the Heretic, which I've been lobbying very heavily for us to do a commentary on one of these days, Eric wrote about Exorcist 2, redo that Pazuzu that you do so well. And finally, The Wick, and this is for you.
Okay.
Reviewed The Thing, the original John Carpenter, The Thing.
Yes.
And here's his review. Sequel pitch. That thing you do crossover.
I like it.
Very nice.
Those are two movies I like. Good job. Thank you to all of you regulars who are crushing it. Thanks to all the new people. Hopefully you guys will continue to post. We're not even halfway through October yet, and we're doing great. So keep it up.
You burnt 8-word reviews.
Seven. Wait. No. I get it. I get good. It. Because we're better.
He's been away,
I've been up
folks.
For, I'm trying to think. In the last 60 hours, I think I've slept 6 hours. So.
But let's focus on.
Sure.
You've been up for the last 24 hours.
More than that, yeah.
Okay. Now explain how we went.
About the last 32 hours.
And in the last 24 hours, I've gotten 5 hours of sleep because I followed my patented method. But as we're going to discuss, this year's was nothing like last year's.
In terms of what?
How you feel when it's done.
Oh, okay. It
was sort of astounding.
Yes.
Explain to the listeners how we did this year.
So we did something different this year for a number of reasons, not all of which I will go into.
We had to change it up.
Yeah.
Baby.
Yeah. I was not really able to attend the massacre at the patio theater, and so JB and Adam Risky were there representing in full effect. And
people were asking about you.
Were they?
Mm-hmm. I just kept saying, well, I had a couple of responses.
All right.
He's Patrick. Dead. Some say he is very beautiful, and yet no one has ever seen his face. But my favorite one, when I use that about half the time, the other half of the time, I would get a very concerned look on my face when they asked me where you were, and I would turn and I would say, he hates you. And he said he would be goddamned if he would ever attend anything that you were.
Good.
And I sold it.
Thank you. Thank you for passing along that message.
I indicated
it's uncomfortable when I have to do it.
I indicated to the questioner that they themselves were the reason for your absence. And, man, did they get mad.
So
they started poking me with a stick.
In a show of solidarity, and also because I didn't want to miss out on a 24-hour horror movie marathon, I did my own 24-hour horror movie marathon at my house.
And I was aware of this and sent him sporadic texts.
Yes.
But part of this trope, this bold experiment indifference, is that I have no idea what he watched. He knows exactly what I watched. I have no idea what he has just sat through.
And the lineup will seem crazy to you. And there were all these different reasons why I picked
Will it not
stuff?
Seem crazy to anyone?
It will seem crazy to everyone. I just...
Is it crazy to you?
A little bit.
Is it crazy to your spirit animal?
There were a lot of different reasons why I picked stuff, and I didn't necessarily sit there and slave over, well, what's the best thing I can show? In a number of instances, I tried to sort of recreate what Rusty does for better and for worse.
I can see where this is going. And, of course, my follow-up question is, usually around Halloween,
it's coming,
you do this right before Halloween.
Yes.
For about 24 hours.
And not quite.
Sometimes climaxes with Scary Movie Night.
Right.
But basically, are you going to do it again in 3 weeks?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I thought of that ahead of time.
Because Scary Movie Night is fun, and my lovely wife has already figured out this very elaborate dessert she's making.
Yum.
Yeah.
So, talk about the experience of it being at the patio first a little bit.
Okay. Back when it was at the Music Box, I discovered the full extent of my OCD, mm-hmm. and I've talked about this a lot, so I'll just mention that at the Music Box Theater, usually, except for this weekend, the happiest place on earth, there's one seat that I really like to get. And apparently it was the favorite seat of at least one other person, so for years I kept getting there earlier and earlier. And I think this culminated in me getting there at around 5:30. And I would sit.
The show starts at noon for all of you listening, and then goes till noon the next day. So
I would stand
there. Extra 7 hours at the beginning.
I would stand there and watch the sun come up on Southport, and I would see yuppies jogging, followed by women. Literally, the walk of shame that you always hear about after a night at those bars, and then yuppie couples walking their children.
People living life, basically,
to restaurants,
is what you're getting at.
And then. Some time would pass, and then the other person who wanted the one seat would show up, and then the two of us would stand there. It was a nightmare. So there isn't one best seat at the patio. So I believe they said they were going to open the doors at 11. I got there at 10:30.
Good.
I got there at 10:30. I was about 10th in line.
Wow.
And I was like, this beats the shit out of that other thing. What was I thinking? And some of my former students were first in line.
Yeah.
They said they got there at 8:30 and stood there alone and watched the street come to life for 2 hours.
Right.
So Adam came, and we had some fun in line. And once again, we were talking to David the Rock Nelson, who's always fun. And then friends of the podcast, Paul and Emma, showed up. And we were trying to figure out in line, where on earth do you sit?
Right.
It's kind of hard. And for some strange reason, there were technical problems with either showing the films or the vendors or something, because they really didn't open the doors until about 11:40.
Yeesh.
And people were getting mad.
Yeah.
By then, there was a line. And because they opened late, they never showed Trailer Trash, which...
That's a bummer.
The massacre usually starts with a half an hour of vintage trailers and short films. And I thought that was interesting, because later, I noticed that David the Rock Nelson had posted on the Facebook that he was specifically going for two things. Trailer Trash and... Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. So I felt bad. Although, as it was happening, I didn't even notice that they had done that until I got home.
Right.
And then I said, oh, they had this other thing. They were trying to get back on schedule, though, which I appreciated. Because the theater's bigger, because the theater's a lot nicer, because there's this sort of handicap bathroom off to the side that not everyone knows about, that was huge.
Yeah.
And I think probably because I finally took Paul's advice and we sat in the front row.
Really?
Because there's enough space between the first row and the screen that you're not looking up at a skyscraper.
Right.
By sitting in the front row, you are very removed from what's going on behind you. And it wasn't until the third or fourth movie that the drunk guy sat behind
us. That's early, too. When I got your text, I thought, wow, that's really... They don't usually show up till 10 o'clock at night.
And this guy was playing a game with a plastic bag that makes noise, and I'm guessing it was beer, and he kept pouring it into a thermos. And, like, the thermos would make this dinging metallic ring. But here's the other difference between the music box and the patio. Far fewer drunken, funny comments.
Good.
And when they did, they were hilarious.
Really?
It was, I started looking, I was like, why don't you guys talk it up a little bit more?
That never happens.
Sitting with Risky is always a trip. That made it better. The venue made it better. It didn't have that oppressive
feeling. The
fact
that I wasn't there, it sounds like, is what really put it over the top.
That couldn't be it.
It sounds like it.
Though I did not indulge, they had a gentleman come and make crepes.
Yes, from the farmer's market near our house.
Right, and at the farmer's market, he does a breakfast thing with, like, fruit. But when I walked past him, he seemed to be doing a thing where it was kind of like a pizza.
Okay.
So that was appreciated. Also, the Burgundy Diner is kitty corner from the patio.
Okay.
And when I took a break to get something to eat, I noticed everyone else in the restaurant was wearing the blue wristband. And then later, Adam skipped out to get a burger or something, and I asked him, he said the same thing. The Burgundy should be kicking back money to the massacre this weekend, because everyone in there was from the massacre.
Was it as well attended as in the past?
Hard to tell.
Okay.
Because...
The theater's bigger.
The theater's a lot bigger.
Right.
So I believe the music box seats 800, and the patio seats about 1,200. I don't know if that's with the balcony or without, but... People were spread out, but not as spread out as at the Portage last year.
Okay.
The thing is, the music box sells out, so every seat's taken, and it gets kind of oppressive sometimes.
Yes.
This never got oppressive, but when I left, because I usually leave, get some sleep, take a shower, and come back, I was amazed at how crowded it was.
Okay.
Because, again, when you're sitting in the front row, this might be a key to focusing on the films. The patio is a much better venue for the massacre than the Portage was. I still have an amount of affection for the Music Box, but in a weird way, I think it might even be better than the Music Box for the Massacre.
Sure. The Music Box is doing their own 24-hour festival next weekend, the Music Box of Horrors. Adam Riske will be attending part of it.
Yes. Go up to Adam, say hi, and dart your tongue into his ear. I discovered during Tomb of Ligeia that he really likes
that. He likes that. What was your first movie?
Okay, we started because Rusty usually starts in chronological order, and then that kind of gets thrown to the four winds about 3 o'clock in the morning. He showed the night.
Not even that. It's like the first two movies, and then he throws it out.
You're right.
It goes silent, universal, anything goes.
Anything goes. That's what I'm thinking, because I'm usually more excited for the silent and the universal than anything else. At noon, approximately, he showed the 1910 Thomas Edison version of Frankenstein, which
I've never seen. I've seen stills, and that's it.
I believe it's available. Well, there's that one iconic picture.
Right. That's the one I've seen.
I believe it's available on YouTube. Wherever they got it from, there was a burn-in thing, copyright video seller, because people are constantly trying to copyright it. Good luck in the age of YouTube. Have fun with that. They redid the titles, so the title cards looked brand spanking new, and then it would go to the film, and the film is in rough shape. In fact, for decades, it was considered a lost film.
Right.
I really like it, if only for its ambition. I mean, trying to tell that story in, I think, 9 minutes.
Yeah.
But the thing I really liked, and my 7-word review tried to hint at this, because the whole thing is going to this mirror gag, the whole thing seems designed to end with this mirror gag at the end, when Frankenstein, the doctor, walks in the room, and in the mirror, his reflection is the monster. And because he's pure of heart, and because it's 1910 and no one knows how to make movies yet, the monster gradually fades because of the love in his heart, and he sees himself. Because the filmmakers know they're going there, there's a whole bunch of shots that are set up unlike any other silent film I've ever seen, where characters are reacting to things that take place off screen, but that we see in a mirror.
Right.
That's really damn sophisticated for 1910, when things are like photograph stage play. The film is in such bad shape, it's hard to see the monster, so you're better off Googling Edison Frankenstein and seeing that. It was from a trade publication. It's Charles Ogle in the makeup.
Right.
But what a fun way to start.
Yeah.
I thought, a little history for people. And then Frankenstein meets the Wolfman. And again, I wished I should have said something, but I never did, that I was hoping in my fantasies that I would be allowed to introduce the film, because I thought I could have said something that would have had the audience enjoy it a lot more. At the end of the previous Universal entry, Igor, played by Bela Lugosi, his brain has been transplanted into the head of the monster. The monster actually talks with Igor's voice, but for some crazy reason, the blood doesn't match, and now the monster's blind.
Right.
So they make Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, and Frankenstein's monster talks a lot in Igor's voice, and the studio heads see it, and it's funny. So they cut all of his dialogue out. There's scenes where you can still see his mouth move, and they've just deleted it. And Frankenstein walks around like he's blind. So the popular culture image of the Frankenstein monster walking with both hands outstretched, that's because of that.
Right.
Still, it's a lot of fun. Paul and Emma and Adam, and I think even David the Rock Nelson, could not figure out the amount of hipster douchebag laughter. I don't get it. There's a scene where, like, they find the victim of one of the Wolfman's murders.
Hilarious.
Ha ha, someone died during one of the transformations.
It's funny. It's old, and it's funny.
But I actually began to think that in some cases, it was when some character on the screen, directly and without irony, stated an emotion.
Yeah, for sure.
That's what they're secretly afraid of.
Yeah.
It's possible to live without ironic distance, that concept is so terrifying to them,
yeah.
They're protecting themselves from it with laughter. It was good to see Frankenstein meets the Wolfman on a big screen.
I had thought about putting that first for my basement massacre, but instead I just watched it by myself last week or the week before.
So what did you watch at noon?
So I watched, I guess, the sequel, House of Frankenstein.
Yes.
Which I had seen a couple times before. I didn't know how much of this I was going to be alone or what when I started making the lineup, but I was joined for all of it. Doug joined me for all of it. So some of the programming choices I made were, oh, okay, well, Doug will maybe want to see this. He had never seen House of Frankenstein, so it was interesting for him to see it because he didn't have the backstory. And that movie bends over backwards to sort of say, we fell and we were frozen in ice.
Yeah.
That's, I'm still stuck on the Dracula stuff. Like it's introduced. We spend 10 or 15 minutes on John Carradine as Dracula, and then he's out for the rest of the movie.
Okay.
And he's the worst Dracula. He's worse than Lon Chaney Jr. in Son of Dracula. Yes, I can't handle a mustachio Dracula, period.
He's the effete.
He's the worst.
He's Dracula. The Shakespearean Dracula. But my problem with that is I'm constantly confusing House of Frankenstein with House of Dracula.
House of Dracula is where it's like, I'm a crazy doctor, and I think I'm Dracula.
Right, but that without telling anyone, they decided to include Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde,
right.
And that's the game they're playing with the doctor who puts right. Dracula's blood into
right.
him,
right.
And that's Onslow Stevens. So House of Frankenstein is the one with Lampini's
yes.
Circus of...
Boris Karloff and Daniel, is that the Hunchback?
J. Carroll Nash.
They escape this prison...
Right.
And they pick up Dracula, and then he's in for 15 minutes.
Right. And
then they sell him out.
He's in a carriage.
Right.
And he, right. So we get rid of Dracula early on.
Then we find the Wolfman and Frankenstein's monster frozen in ice, thaw them out so they can help Karloff find Frankenstein's notes.
Right.
Like, Wolfman, let me thaw you out. Can you help me find this notebook?
So House of Dracula is the one with the fungus. That you can use to fix someone's...
Yeah, there's no fungus. There's a lot of... They plan to do a lot of brain swapping. It has
right.
the gypsy girl
and
Daniel is in love with.
Ilona Massey.
Right.
But the gypsy's in love with...
Lon Chaney.
Because he's a hunk.
Well, and he won't stop talking about how he turns into a wolf when the moon is full.
Which,
every one of his lines
I wonder,
is, you don't understand, I turn into a monster.
I always wonder when I watch Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, which is still a couple years down the road,
yeah.
That movie actually makes fun of that, how obsessed he is with talking about.
You it's the only thing he talks about.
Soon the moon will rise. I'll turn into a wolf. And Bud Abbott's famous response, I mean, Lou Costello's famous response, yeah, you and 70 million other guys. Because in House of Dracula, there's a hunchback woman. There's
right.
a hunchback nurse
right.
that Onslow Stevens promises to cure.
Right.
But in House of Frankenstein, J. Carroll Nash is in love with the gypsy
he's
girl.
He's not going to cure the hunchback. He's going to give him a new body. He's
right.
going to give him Larry Talbot's body.
And which is doubly good for him because the
right.
gypsy's already in love with Lunkhead.
Right. right. I like, obviously, the movies that mix all of the monsters
the
together.
The monster rallies,
yeah.
as they're called.
So it's certainly fun, and Boris Karloff is very entertaining in the lead. It's interesting to see how the quality of the makeups had really slid, especially on Glenn Strange, as the monster. But even the Wolfman makeup, I feel like, was inferior to what they were doing in the original Wolfman.
Well, apparently at some point, and I think it might be when Universal became Universal International, they really unceremoniously fired Pierce. Who has made them how many tens of millions
right,
of dollars?
Yeah, right.
And because he was too slow. Because
right.
there's a reason why it looks so good.
Right.
It took him 5 hours.
Right.
But you could make the head out of rubber, and
yeah.
then that'll save you some time.
And it shows, I think.
One more great thing about Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, if you ever watch it, about halfway through the film, we're in a gypsy camp, and there's a dog that the cameraman uses an excuse to make a pan. That's Lon Chaney's real dog.
Oh.
And apparently they were thick as thieves. He had something for this dog. The dog was famous. The dog's name was Moose. And you can tell in the film, for even a little amount of time that he's in the film,
yeah.
That's that guy's dog. That's that guy's real dog. What did Doug think of House of Frankenstein?
To be honest, I can't speak for Doug. I couldn't get a read on anything that he saw. And part of that was just because of the format. He was just tired and not talking about stuff.
Was he drunk again?
He was not drunk again. This was one of the few...
Do we need...
This is one of the few days, I think, where he didn't drink.
Do we need to have another intervention?
He was shaking a lot, though. Is that normal?
Maybe he's trying to stop again.
Maybe.
The BP.
So I think he thought it was charming, as we all do. But I think aside from Evan Costello Meet Frankenstein, I think my favorite monster rally movie, if it counts, is Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. I like that better than House of Frankenstein.
And I often wish that someone could put it back together so we can see this apparently risible sight of Bela Lugosi saying all these lines. One more thing,
yes.
And I can one more thing you forever with Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. When Lon Chaney finds him in the ice at the beginning of Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, not the time they find him in the ice in yours.
Because they're both in ice in that one.
The Frankenstein is really impressive, and that's because for that shot, it's Eddie Parker, who was a stuntman. And at the end of the film, when we finally get less than 5 minutes of the two of them fighting, like that the fat drunk, he's not drunk, the fat owner of the bar dynamites the dam. And I'm, like, wishing the water would stay back because I just want to see them fight longer. You don't really get much of a fight.
Frankenstein sort of meets the Wolfman.
Almost every shot in that, it's Eddie Parker as the monster, not Bella, because the feeling was in one shot, when a big beam comes down, you can tell they're both dummies. And this is the advantage that they didn't want to risk.
Right.
Hurting the actors.
Right.
And this is one of the advantages of the big screen because it's so readily apparent.
Right,
but
right.
They should have just let stuntman Eddie Parker play the monster, which, of course, they wind up doing because Glenn Strange was a stuntman. And he was in a lot of Westerns.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, so what's next for you?
And then they had some auctions for the charity. And if you're interested, their charity is Vital Bridges, which provides assistance and food for victims of AIDS. And then they showed a short film, which was an adaptation of Cask of Amontillado, which sort of tried to update it so that it's taking place now in a family that makes wine and it's brother against brother. Not a fan, sort of interesting, certainly well-intentioned, but...
It's great that they show those short films, but they tend to be a mixed bag.
And later, he did the Roger Corman... Roger Corman trailer.
Yeah.
And I think it was at the Sci-Fi Spectacular. That's when Adam went to get food. And that was like a highlight of it. It was so funny. Werewolf on the moon. Because on the moon, it's always a full moon. So one of the trailers, Schrodinger's Mummy.
Okay.
I was crying. I was laughing so hard. And people were laughing so hard they were missing jokes. That one won.
Okay.
It was a competition. I'm not sure what they won, but they do it by applause. And I think they had about 10 of them.
Oh, wow.
It's really, you got to applaud Rusty for doing that. And right before Army of Darkness, he showed a short film, which I believe, folks, if you're not very religious, is available on YouTube, Fist of Jesus.
Okay.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. It was either made in Mexico or Spain. It's in Spanish with subtitles.
Yeah.
And it, I don't want to give it away.
Okay. Fist of Jesus.
But again, short film.
Got it.
Then he shows what I always thought was the Tomb of Ligia.
Okay.
But I guess it's Ligia.
Right.
And this is one of the lesser of the Poe adaptations. It's got a really great first half hour with... Vincent Price in that hat and those sunglasses and stuff. And it almost seems like that should be the short film. And then they have to figure out how to make it 90 minutes.
Right.
So you have this endless middle half hour that's just padding doesn't go far enough. And then kind of an interesting third act. But of all the Corman Poe films, I think it might be my least favorite. But beautiful print.
Really?
And again, for the first half hour, and clearly you can see this at home, and the Blu-rays are coming out in like 2 weeks. Those films are so beautiful to look at. The production design and the lighting, and Corman, man, when he was interested
when he was trying, right? Yeah,
so beautiful. I
love
to look
those.
At.
I love those Poe movies, and he's good about showing those every couple of years.
And that's another thing we have to thank Rusty for, because I had seen them butchered and looking bad on the 330 movie when I was a kid. But I still remember the first time Rusty showed one of the Corman Poes.
Mask of the Red Death.
And both my son and I were like, holy shit.
Right, well, that's Nicholas Rogue doing cinematography. That was Joe Dante's personal print of the movie that he brought, so it was taken care of.
And whatever year that was the highlight of the whole.
Yeah, that was the movie that really made me fall in love with those Corman Poe movies.
And so what are you watching it to?
Two, I watched Black Christmas.
Right, and that's the one that you tipped in a text.
Oh, okay.
And now you have to help me out.
Okay.
Because there's a whole bunch of movies I confuse with Black Christmas.
I had never seen Black Christmas. This was Black Christmas. Bob Clark.
Okay.
Sorority Girls in Canada. Margot Kidder, Andrea Martin, Olivia Hussey.
And I've never seen it.
Really?
But there's a killer Santa Claus at one point.
Not exactly, no.
Okay, then I'm getting it confused with all those killer Santa Claus.
Yeah, you've never seen Black Christmas.
I've never seen Black Christmas.
You should see it. This was my first viewing. Keir D'Elia is in it. Art Hindle is in it.
So it's not crappy.
No, it's not crappy at all. And we always point to Halloween as being sort of the first slasher movie, and then there's always somebody who knows a little bit more who will say, well, no, really, it's Black Christmas, because that was 74. And they're right in a lot of ways. You watch Black Christmas, and you can even see where Carpenter was borrowing stuff for Halloween. A good horror movie that becomes even better when you consider what it was doing at the time. But it was good. I really liked it. That might have been the high point for me, only because it was something new that I really liked. And I remembered you and I sitting through Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, which was the horror movie that Bob Clark made before Black Christmas, and this is a monumental step forward.
And everyone has always pointed out the irony of the fact that Bob Clark made Black Christmas, and then many years later did A Christmas Story, which is beloved. It's the two sides of Christmas trilogy minus one.
And to be honest, the Christmas aspect of Black Christmas, you can almost do away with. It has nothing to do with Christmas.
Do you now own Black Christmas?
I do.
On what format?
On Blu-ray.
I would really like to borrow it.
Of course.
In fact, once we're done with the podcast and we flip the switch, I just bought something that I think you're going to want to borrow.
Woohoo! It's cocaine!
you wouldn't be borrowing it.
What's next?
Listen, JB, I'll snort it up my nose, but I'll catch it on my tongue. I'll spit it back out. I'll dry it out, maybe outside in the sun, and then I'll give it right back to you. At 3:40, approximately, he shows a short film by Guy Madden.
Yes.
I love Guy Madden.
Yeah.
I just love him to death. One year at Ebertfest, he showed My Winnipeg.
Okay.
And I had never seen anything like it. We've talked about this before on the podcast, that some movies are just one thing.
Yeah.
And then when someone figures out, oh, well, no, it could be five things. And, of course, it helped that Guy Madden was there in person. But he actually got money from Winnipeg to make a documentary about Winnipeg. And what he did was, first of all, half the history in the film is made up.
Right.
He just made stuff up. And then he went back to the house where he actually grew up, rented the house for a month, hired actors to play his family because he thought his personal story was so intrinsic to the history of Winnipeg. They couldn't find anyone to play his sister. So in the film, his sister is a cat. And then it's in black and white with this David Lynch cinematography. So you don't know whether to laugh or scream. The eye, like a strange balloon, mounts toward infinity.
Yeesh.
Was something he made, I think it was a co-production of something in Canada and the BBC.
Okay.
And it's only about 10 minutes long, but it really seems inspired by David Lynch, but it's so much more. He seems to be trying to ape the imagery of early silent films, specifically early Soviet films.
Okay.
And clearly it's abstract, but it's just, it's one of the most, I don't even want to say amazing because that implies goodness. I think some people might react really negatively, but my God, is it its own thing?
The goddamnedest thing.
maybe not the goddamnest thing, but it's certainly a goddamn thing. And then at 3:45,
yes,
they show Martin.
I've never seen Martin.
And apparently, Martin is really hard to see, even though I think I own it on DVD.
Okay.
Maybe it's out of print.
I believe it is.
But I remember there was a time when it was so hard to see Martin that I am an undergraduate at the U of I, and my film professor, Professor David Desser, who, man, he taught me everything I know, arranged for me to see it in the cinema studies offices on a moviola.
Wow.
We sat there one afternoon, and you know how those were.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I saw Martin. And my memory was that it's in black and white.
Okay.
But it's not. There's these flashbacks that might not be flashbacks that are in black and white, but the film is in color.
Okay.
So I'm watching it, and I'm enjoying the hell out of it because it's really good. And at Flashback last summer, Romero said it's his favorite of all the films that he's made. So I'm watching the film, and I'm also watching Risky. Watching the film. At this point, my lovely wife comes down with a Halloween tray.
What did you ask for?
Well, I didn't ask for the Halloween candy. That's value added. But on these little teardrop-shaped plates, there are the monster cereals. Boo Berry and Count Chocula and the like. And did we talk about this last week?
I think so.
I talked about how I was eating Count Chocula.
Yes.
For the month of October, if you would like to find all five of the classic monster cereals, they're available at Target. No money's changed hands in their original retro packaging. So not only can you get Count Chocula, Frankenberry, and Boo Berry, but you can finally taste Yummy Mummy.
Which is good.
Oh, it's really good.
And Fruit Brute.
And Fruit Brute.
Which is not good.
But I would be hard-pressed at telling you which is which. Yummy Mummy, Fruit Brute?
Yeah,
we're pointing to things.
Yeah,
right
we are.
Now.
Sorry about that, guys. This is a podcast.
So I'm sitting next to Risky.
Yep.
Yummy Mummy.
All right.
Jan has just
set us
answered
straight.
All of our questions. Yeah. So I'm sitting next to Risky, and I'm watching Martin, and I'm watching Risky watch Martin, and I could have swore he hated it. I was picking up such a vibe, and when it was over, I said, did you like that? And he said, hell yes, he loved it.
Cool.
He thought it was great. So you never know. If you've never seen it, it's really something.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's low budget. I've heard people criticize John Amplis's performance in the lead role. I think he's perfect. One of my students said he thought Amplis looks like Kiefer Sutherland, which I don't see. But I mentioned that in that film, Amplis sounds exactly like Stephen King.
Oh.
That kind of East Coast, Maine twang.
Right.
And everyone agreed with me. You've never seen it.
Never have.
Assuming it's still upstairs, I'll let you borrow it.
Cool.
It's something. And the last 5 minutes?
Yeah.
So terrific to see it in an audience because there's something you don't see coming.
Got
and the way Romero edits. I don't think this is going to spoil it. But, man, did the audience react.
That and Knight Riders, I think, are the two Romero movies I haven't seen. And Knight Riders is coming out on Blu-ray in November, so I'm excited about that. But, yeah, I would love to see Martin. How are the one of the advantages to these events is that Rusty shows everything on film. How were the prints overall?
This year he did not show everything.
Oh, I take it back. Last year there were some print issues and some projection issues.
Obviously, Edison's Frankenstein was not on film.
Sure.
That'd be something.
Yeah, right.
Folks, we're running silver nitrate stock through the projector. So just as a precaution.
Everyone cross your fingers.
And they give every single audience member a fire extinguisher. Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, I really couldn't tell. Tomb of Lygia was filmed.
Yeah.
That was obviously a print.
That's great.
And that was delightful.
Yeah.
Martin, I believe, was video.
Oh, okay.
I've never seen Martin look that good. And Dead and Buried was obviously video because I started to think that the director was going for some sort of aesthetic, but I think it was just a regular DVD that was sort of smeary the way it gets. But Martin was a highlight. What are you watching at 3:45, approximately?
Okay, so here's where I make a weird call, because we just talked about this movie last week. I watched The Vampire Lovers, which just screened at the Massacre maybe 2 years ago or 3 years ago. It was one of those 5 a.m. movies where you're sort of trying really hard to stay awake. That's the movie where you have to get over the hump, and then you're good from then till the end.
And when Rusty showed that, I had students sitting behind me.
Yes.
And one of them was upbraiding the other one for falling asleep
during the naked lesbianism.
Yeah, during the nudity.
And honestly, the main reason I chose this were A, because I wanted to show a Hammer movie. I wanted to watch a Hammer movie. And B, I had it on Blu-ray. Scream Factory put it out on Blu-ray, and I haven't watched the Blu-ray yet. So here's a great opportunity. The movie is, I enjoy it, but it's silly and pretty nonsensical.
It's thin.
Yeah.
And much of it is a reason to have nudity. I mean, the nudity.
Yeah, but there's not even as much nudity as you remember, you know? Having just watched it yesterday, there's not that. There's a lot of Ingrid Pitt walking around in a nightgown that's sort of sheer, but there's basically only maybe two nude scenes in the movie. I love it for the other girl, not Madeline. Is it Madeline?
Not Madeline Carroll. It's Madeline Smith.
That sounds right. Yes.
Yeah.
I love it for her performance because it's like she doesn't know she's on a movie set. It's the same wide-eyed expression, like she's a 12-year-old for the entire movie.
Wait a minute.
Yes.
Was this the massacre? Was
what?
Maybe it's the bonus features on the.
I didn't go through the bonus features. I'm sorry.
Apparently, she comes across really wide-eyed and naive.
Yes.
And I see. My memory is gone because we've been up for so long. But I thought this was at a massacre, or I had seen her at a convention. It's the bonus features on the disc. If you have the Vampire Lovers Blu-ray, either she acknowledges that she was really like that back then, and this was...
That's the impression I got.
Right? Or, because it's been a while since I've seen it, she's still like that. And when you see her now in the bonus features, you're like, oh, not a performance.
Yeah, it doesn't come across as a performance, but I just love it because her every line delivery is somehow wrong, but great and charming.
And the interviewer on the Blu-ray is a perv. And all he wants to talk about is the nudity.
Really?
And she's so offhand about it. It's like, that's kind of delightful and refreshing. It's like, oh, yes, well, there was a time for that.
My wife joined me for that movie because our children were napping, and there was some discussion during the nude scenes as to whether or not some of the actresses had been surgically enhanced. I felt like it was before that was a thing, but she was pretty positive that Ingrid Pitt had been to the doctor.
I think that's an open secret.
Okay. what is next for you, Jabones?
At this point, it's 5:30, and Gary Sherman.
Oh, yay.
Who seems like, you know how the guests vary, and there's, you know, that they made these films 20 or 30 years ago, so there's, it's like Forrest Gump, you never know what you're going to get. Gary Sherman seems very talented and very together, and he's very aware of the film that he made.
He's a Chicagoan, right?
Yes. He now lives in Chicago. And he explained why at the massacre. That I skipped the middle hour of Dead and Buried because I felt like I had just seen it.
Okay.
But that had to be years ago.
Probably.
Dead and Buried is really good.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that movie.
It starts, and you're like, because there's the perfunctory 10-minute sequence at the beginning that's to...
like a misdirect and a murder.
Yeah. And then gradually, the minute Jack Albertson shows up, you know that you're watching something special. Also, most of the people during the Q&A after the movie, I go out to get something to eat, and I miss the middle of Dead and Buried, but again, I saw the last half hour, and Gary Sherman talked in some detail about working with Stan Winston and how wonderful that was. And I think this is one of Winston's first films where he's doing special effects.
Yeah.
And then at one point that it's the photographer from the beginning of the film is in a hospital bed and he's all bandaged up. And it's not an actor in that scene. It's a puppet that six guys under the bed are manipulating. So later when the girl does what she does, it's a big surprise because she thought it was an actor.
Right.
So that was interesting. The audience really liked Dead and Buried and was with it in Dead and Buried's ironic conceit. They were enjoying it for the same reasons that the filmmakers had infused the film.
Right.
with a little humor. And at the end, and I think I can talk about this without spoilers, Jack Albertson is showing James Ferrantino all these black and white films, which get Ferrantino very agitated. And then the filmmaker, the screenwriter, very wisely holds the final reveal until about 5 minutes later. And I think Jack Albertson actually says, oh, one more thing. And it works so great.
Yeah.
And then a minute later, he tops that with the final shot.
Right.
If you've never seen Dead and Buried, you have to see it this October. It's so fun.
It's a really, really underrated horror movie.
And yet, incredibly gory. I mean, it's, it's rough.
Yeah.
But it has this wonderful, you know, they're my children.
Yeah, it's really, you don't, it's one of those movies that you're watching and you're like, I have no idea where this is going to go. And that happens very rarely. I stumbled across it just on Netflix maybe 2 years ago during Scary Movie Month because it was available for streaming and it came out of nowhere. I was like, wow, that, I had seen the cover art a million times.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, that was so good. So
and
I bought it.
Oddly enough, that iconic image, which shouldn't be, that is what kept me from seeing the film.
Sure.
Every time I saw that for 20 years, I'm like, oh, I think I can skip this.
No, it's really good. Really underrated, and you guys should definitely check it out. After Vampire Lovers, I deliberately programmed a change of pace, and I wanted something...
Something with male nudity.
Light and goofy, and chose to watch Chillerama, which is a movie that I'm very mixed on. It's way too long. It needs to be at least a half an hour shorter. And one of the segments is so bad that I was actually afraid it was going to ruin the rest of the 24 hours. You know, it was fine. In its slot, it was fine because it goes more for comedy than for horror. It changes every 30 minutes, so you're watching something new. One's in the style of a 50s giant monster movie. One's in the style of a 60s beach party movie. One's in the style of a 1940s Universal movie. And then the last one is this crazy zombie movie. So you get a sampling of all kinds of different things. The movie is very mixed. I do believe it's still available on Netflix if you're interested in checking it out, but...
And maybe I'm misremembering this.
No, you're not. The first time I saw it, I really didn't like it.
Because Chillerama is going to come up on the website this week.
Yeah.
Suffice it to say that. And when it was announced, when I saw the advertising materials, maybe I saw the trailer, I thought, that's something I might like. And the only reason I haven't seen it is because you told me not to.
I really didn't like it the first time I saw it, and so much of that has to do with the second segment, which is called I Was a Teenage Werebear. And
is it still on Netflix?
I believe it is.
Oh, well.
So you guys can check it out if you want. What comes after Dead and Buried for you?
Okay. And then, one of the highlights, the Roger Corman 50s Trailer Competition in local short films and trailers. So Rusty had four trailers for horror films that were made locally that are trying to get distribution or trying to get people interested in them or go to the website or go to YouTube and watch them and stuff. And some of those were interesting. But again, he did this Roger Corman thing a couple months ago, and it was so funny. That was the highlight of the Sci-Fi Spectacular that I was so happy that he did it again. They were so good, they made you want to try, because he announced this weekend that the Sci-Fi Spectacular next spring will be at the patio.
Oh, wow, already.
Hasn't announced any of the films, but suggested that they would be doing this again. And I don't want to spoil them. The winner of the competition, I believe it's called Schrodinger's Mummy.
That's what you had said earlier, yeah.
Will be available later this week on Low Carb Comedy.
Okay.
The website.
Okay.
Check it out. There's a thing at the end that's just like one of the funniest things I've seen in months. I don't want to spoil it. So that took up about an hour.
Wow.
And from 7:30 to about 8:30, is that when you're watching Chillerama?
I think so. I might have been on to the next movie.
Okay. So at 8:15 approximately, Fred Walton shows up to introduce April Fool's Day, and this was maybe the one misstep in the massacre, because Fred Walton also directed When a Stranger Calls, which I really, really like. And you could say that it spawned all these babysitting movies, but do you remember when the original When a Stranger Calls was released?
I mean, no, because
I was trying to figure out how old I was.
Yeah.
There's something in that movie, and it's not the big scare everyone remembers from the first 10 minutes. There is something in that movie that is so scary, that is the most scared I've ever been in a movie theater in my life.
Wow.
It's in the last 15 minutes.
Okay.
A beautiful misdirect, and you're confronted with the monster, and I thought I was going to have a heart attack. That's how hard I screamed. I don't think I've screamed more than 3 times in a movie. I jumped in my seat. I clutched my chest. I thought I was going to die. So I wish they had showed When a Stranger Calls. Because I saw April Fool's Day. The weekend had opened. And yeah, I kind of liked it. Walton talked about how it was completely mismarketed. That it was marketed as a straight slasher film. And everyone went and was disappointed because it has a sense of humor.
Right.
I realized that I hadn't seen it since then. Because Tom Wilson shows up in it before Back to the Future.
No, it's after.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's about a year after.
Okay, then that's Walton's mistake.
Maybe they shot it first?
Clayton Romer shows up, and there was a brief period where he was on the verge of being something, and he always plays the same annoying character with the hair. Yeah. And
he was in The Relic, though. He shows up in The Relic.
I've never seen The Relic.
Oh, you would like The Relic.
I'm thinking of the unholy triumvirate of... April Fool's Day.
Yes. Modern Girls?
Yeah, that.
He plays a dual role in Modern Girls.
Oh, God. Because his talent just couldn't be contained by one role.
And just one of the guys?
And that, I found out, personal reminiscence, was the first time our young friend Adam Riske ever saw boobage on the big screen. So that's exciting. And Deborah Foreman, of course, who was so great in Valley Girl and in a much smaller part in Real
Genius. Amy Steele's in that too, right?
Right. And this is a hole in my fan base, in my knowledge base, because when her name came up on screen, everyone applauded.
She's the final girl in Friday the 13th 2.
Okay.
So that's why people love her.
And I'm
one of the most loved.
Have you seen April Fool's Day?
It's, I haven't seen it since high school. It's in my stack to watch this month because I didn't get to see it at the
Because there's a couple girls in April Fool's Day, and I'm wondering which one is April Steele.
Amy Steele.
Amy Steele.
Kind of a strawberry blonde. We can look it up.
All of those women in the film. Oddly enough, except for Deborah Foreman, who's brunette in this one.
Okay.
There's an uptight costume designer. There's kind of the plain girl. And then there's the loudmouth nympho. So
I had to guess, she would be the plain girl. But I could be wrong.
I think you're right. I guess, had some affection for it when it first came out, because at least it was trying to do something different and a sense of humor about it. Oh, how the mighty have fallen.
Really?
It was tedious, up its own ass. And I don't think Riske had ever seen it before, and he had a similar reaction. I would say it was the low point of...
Oh, well, that's not too bad.
The festival.
If that's the low point, you got off easy.
So while I'm sitting through April Fool's Day, what are you watching?
I watched Dead Silence, which was James Wan's follow-up to Saw. And I had seen it when it came out. I think I saw it on DVD. I didn't see it at the theater.
And it released the theater?
Yeah, oh, yeah. The puppets, there's like ventriloquist dummies and... It's problematic.
Okay.
It's problematic.
It wasn't out very long.
Probably not, no.
But, no, I vaguely remember
it. It came out after Saw, and I remember thinking, well, I appreciate that he's trying to do something different, because it's very much sort of this gothic, much more of sort of a ghost story vibe to it. And it was obvious that he was trying to do something different from Saw. And so I appreciate that, but I think audiences said, no, screw that, we liked Saw, we're not going to see this dumb puppet movie. I wasn't crazy about it, but since then, obviously, I liked Insidious enough. I really liked The Conjuring. Insidious 2 had things to like, so I wanted to give James Wan's least successful movie, in my eyes, another chance, and here was an opportunity to do it. My feelings about it are still kind of the same. It's interesting to see him doing some of the things that he would get much better at in The Conjuring and in Insidious. There's a lot of those things that he's starting to do
working out
in Dead Silence, but he's a little bit tied to some of the nonsense from Saw, and it depends really heavily on how scary you find ventriloquist dummies. And I understand, lots of people find those scary. I saw some of Dead of Night the other night on Turner Classic
Movies. It's amazing how popular, but there's a famous Alfred Hitchcock Presents episode too. It's amazing how popular that trope is, the movie magic. which really tells us that a lot of people have a big problem.
But when you do it for 90 minutes straight, you become a little bit numb to it. It's not, nothing could be scary.
No, I would like to name that the 25-minute trope. Yeah, right. You keep, and think about it, Dead of Night,
right.
About, it's right. The longest segment, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, take the commercial.
You time. Mentioning magic, though, just reminded me that I didn't do trailer trash at the beginning. One advantage to The Basement Massacre is that I handpicked trailers before every movie that were sort of thematically appropriate to each movie. So,
and again, in the fashion of he knows what he's doing, whenever we have scary movie night at Patrick, his choice of trailers is tremendous. I don't know how you do it. Now, it's at this point that I have no desire to sit through Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
Because I believe I watched it again at your house.
Yeah.
For the first time since it first came out,
yeah.
And I can still remember my disappointment when Part 2 came out, because I was expecting nothing. Sequels are bad.
Yeah.
But that
yes.
is beyond bad. Although yes. Mark Patton was there in person.
Yes.
And he was signing for free. Excuse me. And he was donating all the money from selling pictures to an AIDS-related charity that he's involved with. So I thought that was nice. But I usually stay till about 2 in the morning after April Fool's Day.
You bailed?
I bailed.
Wow.
Because I have no desire to ever see Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2
again, you're fine.
My entire life. And
that would have been a movie filled with ironic laughter. And unfortunately, and I'm not a fan of the ironic laughter, that's the only way to watch that movie at this point.
Well, and that's what you brought to the party.
Because of the disconnect.
I certainly didn't notice that the first time I saw it. And the second time I saw it in your basement... That's
right.
I was beating myself up. How could I not have noticed?
It was written by a homosexual screenwriter. Mark Patton was closeted at the time, but is a gay man. Jack Shoulder directed the movie and still to this day contends he has no idea why people see homosexual subtext in the movie. But that movie is nothing but homosexual
subtext. So he's in denial.
Apparently.
And then that was followed by The Gate.
You left at the right time.
And oddly enough, one of the vendors' tables was selling little replicas of those little demons.
Yeah.
Now, is it a door? Something falls and becomes little demons.
I think it's a
demons.
Person that falls and becomes a bunch of little people.
A bunch of little people.
If memory serves.
And that's the reason I went to that movie
that's
when
the
it came out.
That's the reason anyone went to that movie.
Because that was in the trailer.
Yes.
And you were tricked
right.
into thinking,
right.
man, if that kind of thing happened, that would
it's a
be
movie
something.
Full of that. No.
It's not at all.
No.
So I drove home, and that's another advantage of the patio, about half the distance.
Yeah, right.
And then I got 5 hours of sleep. And as I'm sleeping, which is important because I'm an old man, what are you watching in your basement?
What else do they show while you're sleeping? Wild Zero, Deep Red.
They're showing Wild Zero, okay. Deep Red, and Hellraiser 2.
Oh, boy. I kind of like Hellraiser 2 because it's nutty.
And as I told you before we started up the machine...
the computer.
No, I'm really into this. You know, the wireless. And... because it was so delightful to see life and get fresh air, you know, 4 hours earlier than you usually do.
Yeah.
I almost drove to your house, and did I tell you this already?
Yeah.
And I was going to watch one movie you with
you. You for sure would have been disappointed by whatever we were watching.
So if I had shown up...
Okay, at what time?
At around 11...
Okay.
What would I have seen?
You would have seen the last half hour, roughly, although we were a little bit behind... of Sleepwalkers, which I haven't seen in a long time. Mick Garris directs, 93. Stephen King's first screenplay, not based on source material. Alice Krieg and Brian Krause are a mother and son who are also having sex with each other.
No, I remember it.
Okay, and they're terrified of cats.
But I've never seen it.
Oh, okay. I think it's a lot of fun. It's a movie that knows exactly what it is. Somebody gets stabbed with a corn cob.
And that actually would have fit in well, because actually at the massacre, it was the strangest thing. Because the Tomb of Ligeia focuses so much on this creepy cat.
Yeah, right, right.
It put cats in everyone's mind.
Yeah.
So for the rest of the night, that's a pretty popular thing in horror movies.
Yeah.
Every time a cat would show up, it was like a shout-out to Ligeia. And at your house, I would have enjoyed the cats. Now, when Sleepwalkers is over,
yes,
what would I have seen?
Next, you would have seen a movie that was new to me, which was why I chose to watch it, and that is the newly released direct-to-DVD Curse of Chucky, the sixth movie in the Child's Play franchise.
Well, then clearly, instead of an extra hours of sleep...
Yeah, you should not have come over.
No. I should have.
I don't think so.
I would have enjoyed that.
Maybe. It's so Don Mancini, who's written all of the movies and directed the last one, I think. He also directed Seed of Chucky. Writes and directs this one. They're clearly taking a very different approach, and for an hour, it's just this weird sort of... It's all in this mansion, this big, dark, gothic mansion, and there's a family staying there.
Low budget.
Yeah, you could tell. And you know that Chucky is killing them off, but you're not seeing the doll, and he's not cracking wise, and he's just a doll, and then people are getting murdered, you know.
Seems like an interesting approach.
And then in the last half hour, it becomes a really stupid sequel to the other films. Has three different endings, none of which are in agreement with one another. It was like watching Clue the movie. Like, well, maybe it was this, or maybe it was this, but it's not. It's
all supposed to be one ending. Three,
or? No, it's all supposed to be one movie. It's not, these are alternate endings.
Okay, it's not bonus features.
It just felt that way, because these endings literally cancel one another out. The main reason to see the movie is that there's a pretty good lead performance by, I'm going to blank on her, Fiona, I believe is her first name, Dorif, Brad Dorif's daughter, who plays the main character. She's a girl in a wheelchair.
Was that your review? Two Dorifs for the price of one or something?
No, I haven't done a review yet.
Okay, someone reviewed.
But I did laugh, because somebody wrote something, I think Adam Risky wrote something about a chili scene. There is literally a scene where people make and eat chili that goes on for 15 minutes. You can't believe that this chili scene is still going.
The director likes chili. As you're describing it, I'm thinking this first hour sounds interesting, although the more I think about it, you know it's a Chucky movie.
Yes.
What is the point?
Exactly.
Of, we know...
Or just stick with that approach the whole time, and it's like, this is a very different kind of Chucky movie. I'm okay with
different
that.
Different direction.
You think they're kind of rebooting, and instead it just gets very stupid. So that was kind of a disappointment, but again, I'm glad to have seen it. After that, what am I watching? Cue the Winged Serpent, which we saw a couple years ago at a sci-fi spectacular. And again, this was because at 2 or 3 a.m. you want to watch something goofy that... If you fall asleep, it's okay. And then if you wake up, you want to see something crazy and wonder if you dreamed it or not, that kind of thing. So
I've always thought Rusty, that's when he shows the Italian horror.
Oh, don't wait. Just wait.
To a certain person, it's like a lullaby that lulls you to sleep.
And then you wake up, and it doesn't matter how many times you drift in and out of the movie. It makes as much sense as if you stayed awake the whole time. So
I really like Q.
I do, too. It's a lot of fun, and Michael Moriarty is crazy. And I had the Blu-ray and wanted a chance to watch that. Then I take a page from Rusty and very foolishly program an Italian horror film, despite the fact that I have yet to find an Italian horror film that I like. I watched Umberto Lenzi's Nightmare City, which I had even seen before, so why I chose to watch it again.
You are a glutton for punishment.
Oh, this is the movie I should have slept during, because it was rough.
You know, actually, in terms of simulating the massacre, you would have been allowed to.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. The main actor in this movie is a guy named Hugo Stiglitz, which is interesting just because Tarantino names a character that in Inglourious Basterds. This... When Grindhouse came out, a lot of people said that this movie was the inspiration for Planet Terror. It involves a lot of people with, like, crispy heads just stabbing women in the boobs. It's not a good movie.
I could see that on the poster.
Don't ever see it. So this is the rough patch. Because
there's a lot of people stabbing people in the boobs. P. Bromley, F this movie.
Cue the Winged Serpent is a fun movie, but it's rough at 3 a.m. and then right into this Italian horror movie. That's rough. And then after that, I programmed a movie that I had never seen around 5 in the morning, which was Dark Knight of the Scarecrow.
Yeah.
Which I know they showed at a massacre a couple years ago, but this was before I was staying the whole time.
And where the hell was I? I've been to a horror convention where they showed it like a year before it came out on video because it was this thing that people remembered.
Yeah.
And the director was there.
Okay.
Ferguson?
I don't know.
And he's selling masks like the Scarecrow. And I always thought the most interesting thing about that film, Larry Drake notwithstanding, is Turning.
Yeah.
That
came out a year after the Muppet movie. So in the span of a year, he's the guy who murders an innocent,
mentally
disabled man and tries to kill and eat Kermit the Frog. He's the most hated man in America.
And actually, who was it? Was it Fred Walton? Yes, it was Fred Walton. During the Fred Walton Q&A, our friend Paul, who's very up on these things, said, can you comment on your friendship with Charles Durning? Fred Walton had made some films with Durning in them and actually got to be personal friends. And he was sharing, I guess Durning lied about his age to fight in World War II and saw horrible, horrible action on Normandy, which he refused to talk about for the rest of his life. So there's the Durning connection. My guess is you were disappointed by Scarecrow.
I thought it was fine, and it felt like it brought me back to life a little bit after Nightmare City because I was able to get invested in what was going on. It wasn't particularly scary, and the deal is that it was this TV movie that people loved and was unavailable for years and years, and now it's out. It's hard to get past those first 15 minutes with Larry Drake.
Oh, no.
The way they costume him. He refers to himself in the third person as Bubba. I mean,
I've always thought, because I remember seeing it the night it premiered, that it was a sensation.
Yeah.
But there were only three television networks.
Right.
And I believe it was Halloween time, and it had Scarecrow in the title.
Right.
And it's interrupted by commercials. There's a whole bunch of reasons. And then you can't see it forever.
Right.
And so what you're carrying around is not the movie, but your childhood memories of the movie.
Yes.
Because when I saw it again at the fan convention, I was underwhelmed.
It's okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's okay.
But then you wonder if the same holds true for Trilogy of Terror.
Right.
Which you could say everyone's affection for that is based solely on the final sequence.
Sure.
And you're not used to seeing anything scary on TV because, as Stephen King points out in Dance Macabre, TV didn't want things to be too scary.
Right.
They were afraid people would turn it off.
Right.
And then you don't see the commercials.
So I have one more movie before you come back, I think, and then we each have two left. So I watched Nightbreed, Clive Barker's Nightbreed, which I haven't seen since probably 1990. And I know that next year Scream Factory is putting out the Cabal cut, like 70% new footage. And I know it has screened before in Chicago, and I was actually going to go, and I know the quality was rough. It was hard to get a sense of the movie because it's switching from film to video, and the video is in bad shape. But the main reason I kind of chose not to go was because I'm not familiar enough with the theatrical cut to know what's different. So I wanted to refamiliarize myself with the theatrical cut. There's a lot to like in Nightbreed. I don't know if it works as a movie, but it is a horror movie unlike any other horror movie I've ever seen.
And I can still remember seeing that the weekend it came out and knowing something was up.
Yeah, especially in the second half of that movie.
The first thing you thought was, this is very different. And the second thing you thought was, this is not what this was supposed to be.
Yeah, the second half, it just jumps around in crazy ways and it stops making sense, but tons of cool monsters. Fun to see David Cronenberg play a bad guy. Lots of neat stuff in it. So, and I commented when I was watching it that Danny Elfman does the score, and while his scores have become very familiar and repetitive, there was something about hearing his score over that movie that after the last three or four things that I had seen, I felt like I was watching a real movie again. Like, oh, this feels polished and done. Like, professionals worked on this. So that was kind of neat.
The first time they show the monsters, does it go oompa, 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 oompa,
yes.
Oompa, oompa, oompa. So if I could shower instantaneously.
Yes.
Or turn back time.
Yes.
Or if we actually had that deal from The Fly where you get in one pod and go to another pod.
You end up inside out. It's not worth it.
I so wanted to see Wild Zero. But that didn't work out. Have you seen Wild Zero?
A couple years ago. It was on Netflix, yeah.
And?
Yeah, you know, it's fine. It's a crazy movie. Like, there's a few of those movies that, yeah, this is crazy and very Asian.
I was in the mood for crazy Asians.
All right, well.
The way back to the theater, I ran over a couple.
Oh, good.
And that satisfied
that. That made them crazy.
So So I did get back. My original thought was I'll just catch Army of Darkness at the end, which I've also done. You just swing back in for the last one. But I got back in time for Slither, which is actually a remake, although they don't. It's not anything like the original. The original is a lot different. The original was like a drive-in movie.
Okay. It's not really. It just uses the same title, right?
And also, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I walk back in the theater, and immediately I notice it doesn't have that horrible pall. It doesn't have that refugee camp-like feel of desperation and men's girls trying to talk them into leaving and this stench of popcorn farts.
Yeah,
and it wasn't like that at all.
Good.
Everyone was awake. Everyone was digging it.
Good.
I had never seen Slither.
Really?
No, I missed it.
That's a movie for you.
And I once had it on HD DVD during that 6 months, and I never watched it on HD DVD.
The night it opened, I think, on my birthday in like 2006 or whenever it came out. And we went, and I think we were the only ones in the theater. And I said, well, this movie's done, but I had a great time.
And if it weren't for Martin,
yes,
and some other things, I'd say it was a highlight of this year's massacre. I liked it so much, it gave me even more respect for James Gunn, because I'm such a fan of Super.
Yeah.
And clearly he knows how to direct, and clearly he knows... He's very good with genre and not in a condescending way. And I think I'm catching up on these things, but Nathan Fillion is so great. I had no idea who he was because he's mostly in Joss Whedon stuff, apparently.
He's been just doing TV stuff for years and years.
And he's got some damn TV show on that looks really incredibly stupid. But I was I perked up when he showed up as the sheriff because he's in Much Ado About Nothing, and he's the funniest thing in that film, almost playing... Did you finally catch that?
No, I still haven't.
In Much Ado About Nothing, he's the constable.
Right.
And because it's played modern dress, he's like the police chief, and he's making fun of all the police chiefs he's had to play in his career. He's so good, and I just saw him recently in something else, and I'm like, why doesn't he get more stuff?
Yeah.
Really great. It's got this actress who I confuse with two other actresses.
Elizabeth Banks?
Elizabeth Banks is in Zack and Miri.
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
And was she Alec Baldwin's wife for a season on 30 Rock?
Yes.
Okay, so that's Elizabeth Banks.
Correct.
Who I confuse with Rachel McAdams.
Okay.
And a third woman.
I can see that.
Michael Rooker.
Yeah.
Man.
A crazy Michael Rooker part.
Talk about committing
and,
to the bit.
Greg Henry.
And he's the...
The mayor, I believe. So much fun to watch him.
And again, because James Gunn is master of the subtext, the things that film has to say about religion by way of Slugs and Bugs is really amazing. Comparing the mayor's opening speech in the bar to the beginning of Hunting Season to the point he arrives at the end of the film.
I remember laughing really hard at the last shot of that movie and how dark it was as they step over people.
Oh, yeah. The audience really, really responded, too. In fact, that I thought was the film's one misstep. That ending shot, it's three people basically walking into the sunset, is so beautiful for so many reasons. The song they play over it is a jokey song.
Right, right, right.
It's got the F word in it, and it's like, no, you don't need this.
Right.
You just need music. But it's affectionate about the genre that it's in. It's got crazy... physical effects as well as CGI. I can't believe I had never seen it.
Yeah, it's a ton of fun. My second to last movie was Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon, which I hadn't seen since it played for a very short time in theaters around us, and I saw it in the theater, and then haven't seen it since, and I'm aware that horror people really hold it in high esteem as sort of one of the underrated gems of the 2000s. And it was interesting because my reactions to it were kind of the same as they were when I saw it, which is that for 2/3, it's really great. It's really terrific in the way that it deconstructs so many slasher movies. And then in the last 1/3, it makes a choice that to me is problematic, where it's, it's one of these movies that's about the thing, about the thing, about the thing, about the thing, and then at the end it has to become the thing.
Oh, yeah.
And when it becomes the thing, it's disappointing because about the thing is so great.
And almost every review I've read, because I have never seen it.
Oh, you need to see it.
Almost every review I've read has said the same thing, yeah. That's the problem. Why did you make that decision?
And I watching it this morning, because I don't know if you guys, I don't know if we've announced this. We're recording this immediately after these massacres, so we've been up.
That's why our voices sound different.
That first hour, I was like, man, this is even better than I remember it. And then we get to the last half hour, and it was like, oh, that's why I haven't gone back to this movie. It doesn't ruin the movie. I think the movie's still pretty terrific, but man, that first hour is so fantastic.
It's a roller coaster with a twist. At the end of the roller coaster, it becomes a merry-go-round. If I wanted to ride the merry-go-round, I would have chosen the merry-go-round.
Oh, gosh. And your last movie, sir?
Again, I can't say this enough. I'm sure it's speaking more to my problematic relationship with organized religion. But Fist of Jesus, say what you want. It's... You've never seen anything like this before.
Okay.
You know, talk about commit to the bit.
Yeah.
I'll tease it.
Okay.
The film begins with Jesus raising Lazarus back from the dead, which is a story in the Bible that all Catholics are familiar with. But remember, folks, we're showing this at a horror movie convention. Jesus raised... Okay, that's where I'm going to stop.
Okay.
And then at 9:45, and I think they were early.
Yeah, you got out early.
Yeah.
Because your text to me was before noon.
And someone posted on Facebook, 11:10, hoo-ha!
Yeah, right. Because last year it ran late.
Yeah. He still stopped traffic.
Good.
And on Irving Park Road, that's a lot harder than Southport or Milwaukee.
Yeah, right.
Because at that point, Milwaukee is more like a side street.
Right.
Army of Darkness, which I haven't seen in a really long time, and talk about we know what we're doing, that is, just like The Shining a couple years ago, that is the perfect film to end.
Yeah.
So much fun. I think Risky posted that special effects used to be special because Army of Darkness is made, and there's some stop motion animation and there's some green screen and it's a whole bunch of different things.
A lot of optical effects.
A lot of times, like when there's two Ashes, one of them is an actor.
Right.
They use all sorts of things to trick you. But here's my question about Army of Darkness, though. I think I've watched the DVD so much or I've read so much about it that I tricked myself into thinking the drink the potion and sleep in the cave too long ending is the real one.
It is not. No, the S-Mart is the real ending.
Okay.
The theatrical ending.
And that answers the question.
Yeah.
Why is Fonda in this film?
That I don't know.
She's the girlfriend.
I know. I don't know how that came about. She was friends with somebody.
She's wigged and made up so that she doesn't look like Bridget Fonda that much.
And she hadn't quite popped at the time. I mean, she'd been in stuff, but she wasn't quite yet Bridget Fonda, but it is always jarring. Like, why is she in one shot?
And I read that the studio wanted something more upbeat that reiterated the fact that Ash triumphed, but that Raimi objected. Because Raimi has said he always thought Ash was sort of foolish and should be punished. So again, if you have, I think most of the discs have both.
Yeah.
And clearly Sam Raimi prefers the sleepy ending.
I prefer the theatrical ending.
Because?
I like to see Ash go out as a badass. You know, I understand what he's saying in terms of he is always a fool. He is always getting pushed around and messing up, but... I love the way the energy of that last scene sends you out of the theater on such a high. And that was another movie where in 93, I think I was just able to start driving myself to like the farther away theaters. So I drove myself to Woodfield on opening night and saw Army of Darkness with not a lot of people.
This thing about you driving just makes me feel so old.
Sorry.
I've been driving forever. I have just taken the action figure down from the shelf.
Yes.
This is S-Mart Ash, as he was designated, as he is in the end of the film. I will agree that the ending, the studio ending, the ending that we have, the S-Mart ending, has, you know, 5 more minutes of fighting Deadites, which is a good thing. Right. And I would argue that if we have that cave ending that Sam Raimi prefers, the film no longer ends with him kissing Bridget Fonda and saying,
"That's not Bridget Fonda at the end."
So she's the other one.
She's the beginning. She's the flashback. Maybe that's the confusion. That's not her at the end that he kisses. She's the flashback when he's telling the story about what happened to his wife, when he's recounting the events of Evil Dead 2.
So who does he kiss at the end?
Just a random girl in the...
Hence my comment. Yeah, that it. Doesn't look
Got
like...
It.
Okay.
No, she's just a quick flash at the beginning.
Okay, so now this makes total sense.
Yeah.
That with the ending that Raimi doesn't prefer, with the studio-imposed S-Mart ending, you get this great last line,
right,
and a great line to leave the massacre
right
on.
Definitely. And in trying to sort of ape what Rusty was doing with the massacre, I was trying to
pick... You too watched Army of Darkness.
I should have. I was trying to pick a movie that had that same kind of just fun energy. You've been through a rough 22 hours. You had to watch Nightmare City at 4 in the morning. So I watched Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters.
Oh, yeah.
Which came out in January of this year, and we've talked about a bunch on this site because Adam Risky was a big champion of it. I finally caught up with it on Blu-ray and really liked it. It has very much a Sam Raimi Army of Darkness.
Let's Fight Monsters.
Feel very gory in a fun way.
Risky was trying to get everyone to see it, and no one would.
It's a lot of fun, and it amazes me that the critics in particular, I understand why audiences didn't go see it, but critics in particular were really hard on that movie and just, oh, it's so stupid. That movie knows exactly what it is. There's a
and
ton.
That one actor is not going to appear in junk.
Yeah.
He makes pretty good choices.
Jeremy Renner.
Yeah.
It's really a lot of fun. I really recommend it. It's very funny. It's gory in a fun way. And has that same Sam Raimi energy to it. And it was directed by Tommy Vercola, whose last movie was Dead Snow, which I'm not a huge fan of. So it's nice to see him doing something better. And then that was it. And it was over. 24 hours.
And then...
Good Lord. We've done this 4 years in a row now.
There was the drive home. And again, it's not as if I got that much more sleep than usual. I have to think that it was the people there. It was the venue. It was the movies.
Yeah.
It was a whole bunch of other things. Or could we, as a group... last year have, like, hypnotized each other. And it wasn't as bad as we thought, but it... there was this pall over last year. Last year was over, it was pretty frightening. And this year I feel pretty good.
Good.
Although, again, I have to hand it to Rusty. If you've listened this far, Rusty, we love you. That he usually programs it so that it's the weekend of Columbus Day.
Yes.
So I have tomorrow off.
Yes.
Which is huge.
I do not. So
it's huge.
I'm going to be paying for this tomorrow. But thank you guys for listening. This is always a fun show to do. And this year was different. So it was fun to bounce 25, 26 movies off of one another.
And I'm very much looking forward to Scary Movie Night.
Yes.
I hope I will be invited.
Yes, of course.
Hint, hint.
keep posting your reviews in the Scary Movie Challenge. Keep coming back to F This Movie every day because we're posting tons of stuff. And keep enjoying Scary Movie Month.
Hail to the King, baby. Thank you.